become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MovieGeeksUnite, Facebook at facebook.com/MovieGeeksUnited, YouTube at youtube.com/MovieGeeksUnited, or bookmark our website at MovieGeeksUnited.net. And you can also access our entire library of programs, including more than 600 filmmaker interviews, right here on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/MovieGeeksUnited. For tuning in to the Movie Geeks United Art of Cinematography series. Tonight's guest is Shane Hurlbut. One of the first things you'll notice about Mr. Hurlbut during this conversation is his intense passion for what he does. It's this infectious spirit that has marked his remarkable career in TV and film, with projects like The Rat Pack, Into the Blue, The Greatest Game Ever Played, Drumline, Crazy Beautiful, Something New, Swing Vote, Terminator Salvation, and Act of Valor.
I went to film school at Emerson College. I went there for, you know, film, but really didn't know exactly where I was going to kind of end up. I thought I was going to be a producer, and I was good with money and good with contacts and good with kind of making deals and everything and bringing the team together. And I thought that's what I was destined to do. And, you know, after pounding the pavement in Boston for 3.5 months, just trying to get into any production company and realize that, you know, I had my mom's 3-piece suit on that she bought me for going out there and, you know, getting that job. And, you know, doors were just slammed in my face left and right. I went back to where I had interned, which was a lighting and grip rental company called Film Arts in Boston. And from there, I started right at the ground at the bottom there. And $3.50 an hour, I started packing grip trucks. And out of that, I learned, you know, all the gear, learned how to maintain it, learned how to fix it, learned how to use it, then started running the rental division there, and then eventually realized that the only way that I was going to move up as a technician was to go to Los Angeles. So I moved to L.A. with my fiance, and we landed in Los Angeles, and I started right back at the bottom again. I had kind of moved up to a status in Boston where I was going out on jobs, packing the trucks, being the driver, and also managing the whole gripping and lighting division. So now I went right back to packing trucks again and started a company called Keylight. And this producer came in about a month or so after I started working there and asked me if I wanted to, you know, drive on this feature. And it was called Phantasm 2. And Phantasm was a cult classic. It had, like, the highest grossing horror film back then. You know, they made it for, like, $200,000, and it made, like, $100 million. You know, it was, like, something radical as that, you know. And they wanted a driver, to be able to drive the grip truck, and they were going to get the gear out of Key Light. Well, that job went south, and Key Light didn't get the job, but another company called Lee America, that doesn't exist anymore, got the job. And they came to me and said, would you drive for Lee America? And at that point, I knew in my career, I said, okay, well, here's a sure thing. I'm employed by Key Light every day, or I could go and work on this movie and not know where the future, you know, what the future is going to be. I'm going to just jump. And that's what I did. I left Key Light. I went and started working on this movie. I wasn't employed by, you know, any full-time employment. I was now jumping into the world of freelance. And on that movie, we had this amazing collection of individuals that were all over, you know, technician-wise. I mean, some of them, the best boy electric on the movie happened to be a USC cinematography grad. And he was out there slinging cable and doing everything to be able to, you know, ignite the set and do everything for the gaffer. And it was when we were out in Chatsworth, we took over some weird off, you know, stage over there that was a kind of a industrial building. And we had this crematorium set, and, you know, on the walkie-talkie, you know, the key grip calls in, yeah, bring in a 18 by 24 flag and a C-stand. So I'm like, I grab it off the truck and I'm running it in, and I start to head down into this crematorium set. And on the way up, the best boy electric, his name was Brian Coyne. He's now a director cameraman and has a very successful career. He says, Shane, would this scare you? The set. And I go, what are you talking about, Brian? I got to get this flag down in there. He goes, no, look, every nook and cranny is lit. There's no shadow. And it was like, bam. At that point, everything I looked at was light. And I went from a grip truck driver to a director of photography in 2 years.
Wow.
And that was that kind of defining moment. It's like it was the kind of thing where this, and it's happened very much in my life. It's literally a light switch, and it somehow opened this whole creative, you know, side of my brain that just went, you know, absolutely insane on light. And I just wanted to do everything that involved light, and I studied it, and I read about it, and I did everything I could to kind of, you know, set myself up for success as a cinematographer.
When you embark on a career where you're telling stories with light, I mean, did you always feel that you had a good head for storytelling?
Yeah, you know, I love telling stories. My dad was an amazing storyteller, and so was my mom. So I was kind of surrounded by that. My mom was a sixth grade teacher, and my dad was like a professor's assistant at Cornell. And he always had all these amazing stories. And so as a kid growing up, it was the storytelling that happened around the dinner table that, you know, was a substantial part of my life. And it's kind of something that really energizes me, and I'm very passionate about telling my stories visually as well as in an audible sense of like trying to put you there, put you in the moment. And I think the style of photography of where I've gone in my career, it's really trying to immerse an audience in something that's very intimate, that's very whether it's an action or a drama, it puts you there with the actors, with the performance, and I think it takes you on a very intimate journey that evokes a wonderful emotion and what the characters are going through, and I think the ultimate job of a cinematographer.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, early on in your journey that you've just outlined for us, one of the people that you worked with, maybe you consider him a mentor, was Daniel Pearl, who is a good friend to the show, actually. Didn't you do a lot of music videos in particular with Mr. Pearl?
Oh, yeah. Daniel and I go way back. I think we started working together in 1988. He had the gaffer slot completely locked up by his, you know, friend who he went to college with in Texas. And that was, you know, a position that I couldn't have. So I was like, I want to work with this guy. I think he's one of the most talented cameramen out there. I'll do anything. How about I'm your key grip? And the key grip thing was, you know, when you're kind of studying to be a cinematographer, a gaffer is great, but the key grip is the person that is responsible for, you know, moving the camera and the look and the feel of how that camera moves, as well as shaping the light. And any good director of photography will tell you that shaping the light is everything. And learning how to do that and learning how to control the light and put it exactly where you want it, I learned, you know, way back in the mid-'80s. And I went through, I think I did 3 years with Daniel Pearl as his key grip, and he took me all over the world.
Wow. Well, this interests me because we're talking about the art of storytelling through the cinematography medium. And when I think about commercials and music videos, which is the forum where a lot of DPs get their start, those are formats where you have to be extremely efficient in your storytelling. I mean, you have a limited amount of time to get across what you need to. So is that a really fertile training ground?
Oh, I think so. You know, I absolutely loved the whole idea and the concept behind music videos. I mean, I think, you know, Daniel and I probably did over 100 of those things together. And then as a shooter, I started in 91 with a director cameraman called, his name was Kevin Kerslake. And he really gave me, if Daniel Pearl gave me a lot of the edge in the way I light, Kevin Kerslake gave me the absolute, like, experimental side of my kind of lighting personality, which it was just like, let's just do it and let's not, you know, worry about what is going to, you know, if it doesn't work. It could be brilliant, you know, and those are the kind of things that I just love because he was just balls to the wall, like, let's just try it. I remember shooting a Smashing Pumpkins video where we shot the whole thing on Super 8 at night. Mm-hmm. And Super 8's not the greatest night exterior camera by any means because there wasn't a lot of really fast stocks back in the day. And if you did use a fast stock, it was so grainy that you could barely see the people. So we shot a really low ISO in the middle of the night. I lit this forest up like crazy. And we then processed all of the Super 8 negative in our bathtub. And literally, you know, had the whole developer, the fixer, the whole deal, and we'd slow it down and overexpose it and speed it up and underexpose it. And we did all these different things. And then we said, you know, let's take the negative and drag it down the parking lot. So then we dragged it down the parking lot and made all these funky scratches on it. I mean, we were just so, so crazy with a lot of our visuals and our experimentation. And then I know one, we did a filter music video where we took we shot on 16, we made a dupe of the negative, then made a dupe of the dupe, and made a dupe of that dupe. And what ended up happening was so beautiful because it took all the color and just saturated it so much, and the contrast was so extreme, but it just had such a unique look. And that's what, you know, I really loved about music videos. You just threw it out there, and some of the stuff was absolutely amazing, and some of the stuff just sucked. But, you know, you just went for it, and it really, it started this kind of fearless attitude, fearless passion that I really have as a cinematographer, because I really tend to swing it out there when everyone else kind of plays it safe sometimes.
Well, yeah, and that makes me wonder if it's more difficult to achieve that sense of freedom and that room for experimentation when you're working in the feature film medium.
Well, you know, I think obviously the stakes are much higher, but I still try to have that incredible fearless attitude with anything that I do. Let's take the Rat Pack, for example.
Yeah.
That was my first narrative piece. I was not the pick that HBO wanted. They didn't want me to come within 5 miles of that film. They saw me as a music video shooter, and I could not possibly have a narrative bone in my body. So, you know, Rob Cohen, who was a major mentor to me, getting me into the whole feature world, it was so important for him and I to have this united vision and this vision that we kind of came up together of what this film was going to be and how it was going to look. And I remember the first 2 days of dailies that went to HBO, they were like, what is this? We've never seen anything like this. Da-da-da-da-da. You know, oh, just by the way, we found Shane Hurlbut, okay? This is our guy, you know? And it was like, boom, it flipped like immediately. So good. But, you know, that's the kind of thing. And what I was doing on that was really ballsy as well. And this was something that, you know, you could come in, here's the HBO not really understanding me as an artist, and they didn't really see me shooting this movie, and I could have played it safe and delivered, you know, a nice image, but I didn't. I went for it, and I used all these Harrell references with this very, very high key, and we, you know, lit it where everywhere that, you know, Sinatra and his Rat Pack and his group of homies, wherever they went, they were lit like they were on stage. And, you know, Rob loved this kind of concept of this ability of life. You mean, so when they're on stage, they're lit like a stage performance. And then when they're in their life, they're on the stage. And I'm like, yeah, well, give the perfect 3-point lighting. He's got the backlight. He's got that beautiful key. He's got the... And then he's like, wow, this concept is very interesting. Let's keep on going with it. And then I showed him a lot of the Harrell references, and just we had this major mind meld where, you know, he was so just so forward-thinking and taking this concept and making this thing work. And I thought that the movie had a really unique feel, and it had mm-hmm. something that, you know, you were like, whoa, this isn't a TV movie. And, you know, we did this whole netting the rear element, and we had a whole science to it where, you know, if we were 100 millimeter and down, we would use this Fagal net, and then if we were 100 millimeter and over, we'd use this really thin, cheap stocking net that didn't mush it out too much, and the mix of the smoke and the backlight, and then we used like a Tiffin antique suede No. 3 filter that gave you this kind of yellowing quality that felt, I think, to the period.
That sequence where Sammy performs in front of the large group of racists, and it's that's burned in my brain, the images from that sequence. It's just beautifully done. So I'm crazy about your work in that one. You know, and hearing you talk, it brings to mind a common theme amongst all artists that I've spoken to. I mean, to be an artist, you have to risk failure. I think that's the main criteria.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you kind of, you know, take that from Rat Pack being my first narrative piece, and now you jump all the way forward to, let's say, a project like Act of Valor, where that thing was a recipe for disaster in every way, shape, and form. You're taking a completely untested camera system that nobody had really used and said, okay, we're going to shoot a major motion picture that's going to go in 7,000 theaters worldwide and blow a Canon 5D up to a 60-foot screen. Everyone said I was on crack. And, you know, it's like again, getting back to the storytelling element, this was the only way to tell the story. This was the way to get inside the Navy SEALs. This is what the directors wanted. They wanted to see and deliver images that you felt like you were looking through the eyes of a Navy SEAL.
Tell me what the Canon 5D allowed you to do, that technology.
Well, I mean, it just allowed me to put cameras anywhere. And the biggest one is it enabled me to put a cinematic camera on the SEAL's head and be able to rack focus to the gun sight and then rack focus deep and see the laser on the guy's heart, and then he's just shot. And it's all in one shot. You see that the bullets coming out of the chamber, you see the laser, and then you see the guy drop, all in one shot. You know, none of this stuff had ever really been done before. And it also enabled us, they'd say, okay, you get four people to go on a nuclear sub. I'm like, well, you're not doing that with a film crew.
Yeah.
You
got to
go with a crew that's a director, the cinematographer, an AC, and a sound guy. So I had to go with a camera that could see in the dark. So, and the whole thing was red light mode, so you could barely see, and I had little light panels and little rope lights and everything I was doing and lighting myself, as well as doing all the camera moves. I mean, those kind of things we just couldn't do with, 35-millimeter film or any big HD camera system. It had to be compact and small and nimble, and it had to be able to move, and we had to be able to sprinkle tons of cameras around, and we found that 17 5Ds was the right recipe to be able to keep up with the Navy SEALs.
Wow.
And that was the only way we could do it, because so many times SEALs would say, I'm going to do this twice. I'm going to come in with this helicopter, I'm going to be swinging this boat, I'm going to fast rope down into the boat, we're going to disconnect, and the thing's going to tear off into the sunset twice. So, you know, you have to embed cameras in all different places to be able to tell the story and tell it like a play. And that's where, you know, we really, when I started to get in this kind of headspace where we were shooting it as a play, it wasn't going back to one, okay, let's get the specific shot of the guy coming down the fast rope, and we did. We just did it all as a play. So, you know, we'd mount it to his helmet. He would head down. Then we'd get a guy on the ground on the second time, and we'd see him come at us. And, you know, the helmet cam that he fast roped down into the boat looked up and saw the captain of the ship and moved around and went back down, and the ocean spray is hitting the lens and it's immersive, and then you see the lines, he tilts up and the lines drop out of the helicopter, and he pans over and the whole back end, you know, erupts with with the foam coming out from the engines. That's all in one shot. And you're like, okay, so cool, that's immersive. Now let's put a guy down and he'll watch him come down, as well as we have a 300, a 600, all these different lenses. We got a guy up in the helicopter with the pilot, with the guys jumping out. All this thing was done as a play. And once I started to see the footage come back and how immersive and how real it felt, that was the big thing, because the director – the directing team, Scott Waugh and Mike McCoy, they wanted this to feel real. They didn't want it to be a cinema version of hanging out with the SEALs. They wanted it to feel real, visceral, immersive, and intimate. And I think we succeeded with that, and I think the camera was a wonderful, you know, a wonderful tool to put us in that element.
Aren't you doing something similar, or haven't you done something similar with your last film, Need for Speed? During the chases, you've placed a lot of cameras, haven't you?
Oh, yeah, this thing's going to be off the hook. you know, Scotty and I get together again, and now just imagine Act of Valor, but with cars that go 230 miles an hour.
Wow.
It's like you start to put that together, and you start to embed cameras in places that you've never seen in a car racing, car chase type of film, and it's really unique. I mean, our camera package was 40 cameras. And the way we were able to wheel those things around, you know, each stunt sequence, 28, 22, 18 cameras rolling all at the same time, some operated, some lock off, some embedded, some mounted, all this stuff. It's really it's a unique look inside the art of racing.
You've done your share of period pieces, whether it be the Rat Pack or The Greatest Game Ever Played or We Are Marshall and so on. Is there a danger when you're doing period pieces of pushing the details of the period too far so they draw attention to themselves photographically?
Well, you know, it's the kind of thing where I would say out of all my career of anything that I've ever shot, The Greatest Game Ever Played is probably my favorite film and my best work. That film had a look and a feel, and Bill Paxton, our director, he just really, I think, wanted to get inside the game of golf. And he wanted to be accurate to the period, but he also wanted people to go on a journey, and a journey with the ball. And where this ball is going to take you. And that became kind of the thread of, like, he wanted to use, you know, CGI to be able to get inside the mind of the golfer, because, like, you had all these different visions. Like, Harry Vardon, you would see him at the hole, and you'd push into his eyes, and then the hole had trees, and it had a whole fairway and sand traps and all that stuff, and his vision would vaporize everything, and all he would see was like a lynx, which it was just rolling hills and the pin in the distance. Francis's vision was him being at the tee box and bringing the hole, the green and the pin right to his face, and not seeing 400 and some odd yards and not seeing the hazards and the trees, but just the mental focus of looking right at the pin. And then you had the big guy who just was all about power. So we tried to take those different visions and make it not a period visual style. We wanted it to be very progressive in those visions, very progressive in getting inside the golfer's head, as well as some of the angles and approach. Didn't want to be too to the period. He really wanted to have people in the audience really getting fired up about the game of golf, because the game of golf is not the most exciting thing to watch. So we had, you know, we had to really make it exciting, and I think we did that.
Your use of color, last question for you, in something like Something New, which is a beautifully visualized film, and there's a lot of vivid use of color, and of course that plays into the subtext of the whole theme of the film as well. Tell me about your relationship with color and your conversations about planning out a color palette.
Well, I think so much of making movies now is, I think color is very important. And now with the interjection of digital intermediate and this whole ability to really ISO colors and you can get 13 shades of brown, and really enhance. I remember on Into the Blue, we did all these tests where we were going to shoot film or we were going to shoot video underwater because of the downtime, how long we could be under the water. I opted for film because I found that at 60 some odd feet, you lose the red layer at 25 feet, so skin tones are not possible. I was able to inject skin tones almost all the way to 90 feet. And it's like we didn't want them to look like cadavers. And that was the big thing that John Stockwell said. He goes, I want these people to feel alive. I want Jessica Alba to feel that beautiful tan body underwater. Paul Walker to feel that, golden skin. These guys want to feel alive. They don't want to look like cadavers. So, through all our tests, we really tried to inject the color and bring out that skin tone, even at the depths where it doesn't exist. And I think that really played in the movie and gave it a wonderful sense of style and the way we treated the above, the surface level stuff as well as the underwater. I thought Pete Zuccherini, our director cameraman underwater, was just off the chain. What he delivered there was so spectacular. And then you go to something like Crazy Beautiful, where, John Stockwell wanted to tell this tale, this unique love story, but in the Pacific Palisades. And, he did not want it to feel like every movie that has been shot in L.A. that's on the coast. And I said, well, why don't we do it for what the Palisades really is? It's a kind of, cyany blue, bald sky, gray water kind of feel. That's what the Pacific is really about. It's not aquamarine. It's not anything like the Caribbean. Let's take the Palisades is what it's like. And he really loved that concept. And then we took a film stock that was meant for telecine. We took like a 320 ISO that had all this amazing latitude for the telecine process back in, I think I shot this in 1999. And I took that film stock and it was rated at 320 and I rated it at 40 ASA. So overexposed the crap out of it. And by doing that, it just sent that whole look into something that was just really unique. And the whites, when they went, they blew, but they blew in a way that almost flared the lens. And it had a really kind of contemporary feel. And it was kind of edgy and it was unpredictable. And it was chaotic, and that's what a teenager is.
Yeah.
And I felt that look and feel fit the storytelling element of what is a teenager. They're all over the place. They're not calculated. They're not composed. They're all over the map. They're inconsistent. So I wanted my photography to feel that way as well. And I think that, worked. And then with something new, that was a dupe of a dupe. This was my whole idea. I wanted to take what I learned from filter. I shot it on film, pushed it to HD, and then did a HD extraction. So we took the HD, and then we shot it back on the film. So it was this process that hadn't been done really at that point on a major motion picture. And what it did is it did exactly what it did on the filter video. It made the colors really pop. It made the contrast kind of fall off like a cliff in some places. But then I used this really old glass, like it was made in the 60s, so it had a softer feel to begin with. So that cliff that was added with all the dupe and the dupe and the dupe stuff really had almost halos into the blacks and created this really kind of unique look. Because, I didn't want this love story set in Los Angeles to just be shot normal. I just don't like to do anything that's kind of normal. So I just wanted to really push myself as an artist and say, okay, well, this kind of hasn't been done. And everyone was, like, freaking out. They're like, what do you mean you're going to do a dupe of a dupe and then shoot that out the film? I mean, have you done this before? And I'm like, yeah, I did it on a filter music video on 16mm, and I showed them that. They're like, Jesus Christ, what is that? It's like, that music video was so extreme. It was, like, the wrong thing to show them. But I just love, like, shocking the crap out of the director. She's like, it's not going to look like that, right? And I go, no, when they were very angry. So I had to, my photography had to be very, you know, visceral and everything. So then we did a test, you know, to make Sanaa happy with it. And when she saw it, she was like, I love that. You know, I've never seen something like that. And so that's kind of, you know, how something new came about. And, you know, color is something that I find in this new HD world that we're going into. With film, you could use the wonderful abilities of contrast. You know, film sees so much more color depth than HD does. So the subtle nuances of a shade of brown or a shade of orange or a shade of gold, you really can't get with your 10-bit color space, let's say, with HD. But with film, you could. You can get those subtle nuances. So I find that with HD, you have to build your color contrast more than you would if you were on film. And it's really kind of cool because I love building the color contrast now working with the digital medium where, you know, you go a little further with your blue, maybe in the background, and a little warmer with your warms in the foreground or however you're putting it. But it just... it makes the image be like more three-dimensional and creates a little more depth. And I've really kind of taken that to the next level with A Need for Speed. We were shooting with these cameras, you know, using 4,000 ISO as our main benchmark for shooting our nights. And, you know, you're seeing a night sky, clouds overhead, while these racers are jamming down the road at, 150, 180 miles an hour.
That's it for this episode of The Art of Cinematography. You can find additional interviews from the series at moviegeeksunited.net/art of cinematography.